Good day.
Today is Monday, 24th November 2025, and let me remind you again to tick the like button if once you've watched this programme or that part of the programme that you want to watch, you've liked what you've heard and you want to indicate that fact. Let me also remind you again that I am in Scotland with my family, that this is obviously imposing some time constraints, and again, today's programme, like yesterday's, is going to be shorter than the programmes I do in London. I would quickly and very briefly say that whilst on my travels in Scotland, I've seen more evidence of the state of Britain, and I will discuss that in more detail when I return to London. Without more ado, let's press forward with the topics that I'm going to discuss in this programme, though which will be, again, overwhelmingly focused on the situation in the conflict in Ukraine. Now, if we talk about the diplomacy, if that is the right word to describe what has been happening over the conflict in Ukraine. Anyway, if we discuss the diplomacy since President Trump became president in January of this year, then I think we can say that there is a distinct pattern that develops. Firstly, the Americans contact the Russians. There are some discussions. The Americans come up with a plan. The plan falls well short of what the Russians would agree to, but at least it does represent movement away from the extraordinarily belligerent and entirely nihilistic position of the Biden administration. The Ukrainians are unhappy and the Europeans are furious and are in shock. The Europeans then, together with the Ukrainians, mobilize against the American plan or proposal, or you can call it whatever you like, because in truth, we've never seen anything that remotely resembles a real structured, well thought out plan. But anyway, whatever it is that they mobilize against, whatever it is that the Americans propose, a whole series of discussions then takes place between the Ukrainians and the Americans, and more importantly, perhaps, between the Europeans and the Americans. We are catapulted into that position that was discussed years ago by Eve Smith on that excellent news site, Naked Capitalism, where the Western powers spent all their time negotiating with each other, forgetting completely that the negotiations must ultimately be conducted with the other side. We end up then with a proposal, a reworked proposal, which in effect takes us back to something very close to the nihilism of the Biden administration, and the entire process then collapses. And I suspect we are going through yet another iteration of that cycle. We had it in early March, when the Americans strong-armed the Ukrainians into agreeing to a ceasefire, which would have left the Russians, in control of the territory that they occupied, but which would eventually, as became clear, have frozen the conflict on the existing conflict lines. That, of course, was a non-starter for the Russians, but the Europeans anyway got it changed by getting the Americans to sort of agree to provide Ukraine with security guarantees analogous to NATO membership and deployment of European forces in Ukraine, which was not just a non-starter, but something totally unacceptable to the Russians. Then we got the meeting in Alaska, where the Americans, President Trump, largely accepted Istanbul Plus, with some modifications that Putin alluded to in the recent Security Council meeting in Moscow. It's not difficult to work out what those were. The modifications required a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson region, but did include a complete pullout by the Ukrainians from the Donbass. Again, massive mobilization by the Europeans. Zelensky goes to Washington. All of the European leaders go with him. The Americans then basically go back completely on the agreement, the tentative agreement that they'd reached with the Russians in Alaska. And then a few weeks ago, we had another iteration of this. Putin and Trump speak on the phone. Trump assures Putin that he's going to go back to the Alaska agreement, the agreement that was Istanbul plus, minus a ceasefire in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Anyway, so go back in effect to Alaska. Trump meets with Zelensky immediately after that, and with the Europeans, of course, mobilizing in the background. And with the usual furious articles and commentaries appearing in the European media, all of them insinuating again that Trump is somehow connected to the Russians, or that the Russians have some kind of secret hold over him, or are able to exert some mysterious influence over him. Well, we have we go back again to the freeze idea, but a freeze idea which, as I said, is closer, if anything, to the Biden position. And the Americans, understanding perfectly well that this is unworkable and unacceptable to the Russians, call off further contacts with the Russians. They cancel a summit meeting they had proposed and suggested for Budapest. And the Americans then also, for good measure, slap sanctions on Russia's two big energy companies, Rosneft and Lukoil. And then a few weeks later, news that the Russians are making dramatic progress on the battlefronts. A further panic, the Americans go tell themselves the situation is getting out of hand, Ukraine is losing, we've got to stop the Russians or find some way to stop the Russians. We cannot afford another fall of Saigon moment. They this time contact the Russians again. They have more discussions. They come up with a new peace plan, which is a modified, though somewhat watered down, plan based on the agreements Putin and Trump reached in Anchorage. And then, of course, the whole cycle repeats itself. The Ukrainians are unhappy. The Europeans are furious. The Europeans say this is completely unacceptable. The Europeans mobilize, and this American proposal is going, as we used to say in England, it's going west. In other words, it's dying. And that is exactly what we're now seeing. So there was a meeting in Geneva. Rubio, Witkoff, and Driscoll were there. Driscoll and Witkoff appear to have played some role in putting this plan together. But Rubio, again, as Donald Trump's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, seems to be the person who is leading the discussions. The Europeans put forward a counter-proposal. Note, again, that we are in Eve Smith territory. The Americans and the Europeans are negotiating with each other again. It's worth pointing out that it is the Europeans now putting forward a counter-proposal as if the Europeans were a party to the negotiations. Whoever said they were. Anyway, they put forward a counter-proposal. The counter-proposal, which I have read but I don't propose to repeat, is a rehash of all of the same ideas that we've had in the past. Freeze on the existing conflict lines. The whole thing treats the Russians not just as the wrong party, the aggressor, but also as the defeated party. The Russians have to pay Ukraine compensation. They have to accept, in effect, that the whole operation was outrageous and wrong and submit, in effect, to everything that the Europeans and the Americans are demanding. And at the same time, there are, well, minor concessions, tweaks. The Europeans are graciously willing to allow the Russians to rejoin the G8, something which the Russians have repeatedly and constantly said they don't want to do. Or at least that is what this counter-proposal suggested. Only today, Chancellor of Germany, Friedrich Merz, puts all that in doubt because he says he can't imagine that the other G7 countries, apart from the United States, would look sympathetically upon any proposal for the Russians to rejoin the G8. So it looks as if this European proposal is one that the Europeans immediately intend to back out of as soon as the Russians agree to it and there is a ceasefire. Again, one does wonder about Merz's intelligence. I mean, why trying to deceive and trick the Russians with a proposal of this kind and then announce to the world that you are trying to deceive and trick the Russians with a proposal of this kind? As I said, it baffles me. But anyway, so that's one thing. And then, of course, the Europeans, again, agree that there should be caps on the size of the Ukrainian armed forces. The Americans had previously agreed to a Ukrainian demand that the Ukrainian armed forces be capped at a figure of 600,000 men. But the Europeans say, well, let's actually increase that by further 200,000. Let's say 800,000 men. That this is probably multiples bigger than the actual armed forces that the Ukrainians have deployed on the contact line, the actual contact line, which I am told is probably now closer to 200,000 men than the 250,000 men that was being spoken about in the summer. Anyway, that is a much bigger army, in other words, than the one that the Ukrainians currently have. That, of course, bothers and concerns no one. And of course, the Americans agree to that. They agree that Ukraine should have an army at the end of this process of 800,000 men. How broken, exhausted Ukraine would be able to field such an army? Of course, no one really explains. Perhaps it could be funded by the Russians through these enormous reparations loans that the Europeans are suggesting. In reality, of course, this is a fictitious number which the Europeans are proposing because they know that the Russians will reject it. So this is again where we are. So if the pattern repeats itself, either the Americans will be too embarrassed to put this proposal to the Russians, and the whole process, the whole negotiations process that we are seeing will collapse. That is certainly possible. Putin's envoy, spokesman, Peskov, said today that the Russians are aware of all the media commentary about the meeting in Geneva, but nobody's so far contacted them or told them anything. They're still waiting to see. And there are no indications yet that there will be any future contacts, any meetings between the Russians and the Americans at any proximate point. Both the Kremlin spokesman, Peskov, and I believe Levitt, the White House spokesman, has said the same thing about this. So there is no movement so far towards a Russian-American meeting. There's been some reports that Driscoll is eventually intending to go to Moscow, but no word of when or in what way. Or alternatively, Driscoll will indeed go back to Moscow with this cobbled together, mixed up proposal that the Americans have not just watered down after they've been hearing from the Ukrainians and from the Europeans, but which has been completely reworked into something that actually ultimately doesn't differ that radically from the already rejected by the Russians and completely discredited Kellogg freeze plan. And speaking of Kellogg, I noticed that he is in fact back. He's supposed to be resigning or quitting his post in January, but he's clearly very active at the moment. He's been going round about the media places. He's giving his views. He says that we're close to a deal, as basically he was saying previously in the spring. He says that he's happy with the deal. He gives every indication of being happy with the deal. And of course, why wouldn't he say that? Because the deal that we are seeing come out of Geneva is essentially the same deal as the deal which the Russians have already repeatedly rejected. So it could be that Driscoll will take this plan, so-called, to the Russians at some point over the next few weeks. And of course the Russians are going to reject it. And we know that because the Russians have already rejected it previously. And the Russians, indeed Putin himself at that recent Security Council meeting, but the Russians have repeatedly said that any move towards a peace settlement of this conflict, a negotiated peace settlement, which, to repeat again, Putin also said at the Security Council meeting, is not the optimal outcome from a Russian point of view. They would prefer a military victory. Anyway, the Russians will say that the only basis upon which they're prepared to move forward and to negotiate is on the basis of what they agreed with Trump and Witkoff in Alaska. And this differs so far from what was proposed by Witkoff and agreed by Putin in Alaska that it obviously cannot and will not work and is not something that the Russians are prepared to entertain. So at this point, we will no doubt have the usual cycle. The Americans, well, the Europeans will say that the Russians are again insisting on acceptance of their maximalist proposals, they're being intransigent, they're rejecting peace proposals. We'll have the usual statements from Keir Starmer, assuming he's still Prime Minister over the next few weeks. He might, by the way, be gone fairly soon. And Emmanuel Macron and Friedrich Merz demanding that the Russians accept without change or amendment the proposal which the Europeans have worked so hard to change and amend in the way that they wish. Anyway, they will insist that the Russians must take it or leave it. When the Russians leave it, the Europeans will say that it's the Russians are not really interested in peace and are not interested in returning to the negotiating table, and they will demand more sanctions. Sanctions this time, obviously, from the United States, and a renewed flow of weapons to Ukraine from the United States. So this is, at the moment, the scenario that is laying itself out for us. One person, I think, does sense this, and yesterday made a Truth Social post which expresses his frustration. In fact, he boiled over. He spoke very critically about the Europeans in a Truth Social post, and he expressed himself very critically about the Ukrainians. He said that they'd showed zero gratitude for all the help that the Americans have given them. That person is, of course, Donald Trump, and he did so in his post on Truth Social. But even that Truth Social post still shows, at least to me, that Trump doesn't really get this. Even now, even after all of the months that have passed since the conflict began, since he became president. Because in that same Truth Social post, he made it out that the entire war is the result of an act of aggression by the Russians, supposedly Putin took advantage of the fact that sleepy Joe Biden was in charge in the United States. If it had been Trump who was president after the 2020 election, Putin would never have dared, supposedly, to act in the way that he did. And the result is that it's been left to Trump again to sort out this mess. But the Ukrainians are showing zero gratitude for that. And the Europeans are not even joining the Americans in imposing the massive sanctions to stop oil deliveries to Russian oil exports to India and China. And indeed, despite their recent promises, they continue to import oil from Russia. Well, Trump saying all of that, of course, goes against what he has himself previously said. He has at various times acknowledged that NATO membership for Ukraine was a major issue for the Russians and was one of the factors that led to the conflict in Ukraine. But the Russians, reading that Truth Social post, are going to pick up the fact that despite all of the painstaking explanations Putin has given to Trump and Dmitriev has given to Witkoff and Putin himself has given to Witkoff, the Americans still are not really accepting or believing or showing any real interest in what the Russians say were the root causes of the war. The reasons why Putin in February 2022 decided that Russia had no option but to start the special military operation. Will Trump take his frustration so far that he's going to tear up whatever new proposals the Europeans and the Ukrainians put to him and Zelensky puts to him in whatever meeting supposedly is going to take place between the two at some point in the next few days? Indeed, there are some reports that Zelensky and Trump are going to meet in the next few weeks, in which case the 27th of November deadline that we have been hearing so much about, that deadline has now been dropped. Just saying. Well, I don't believe that Trump is going to do that. He hasn't done that at any point up to now. He's in a much weaker position domestically than he was in January. I don't believe that he has the political strength any longer to stand up to the neocons or to the Europeans or indeed to the Ukrainians for that matter. And I believe that as he has consistently done ever since Anchorage, he will flip-flop back to the Ukrainian-European position. And Putin has said already, for us, that's fine. We're perfectly happy with that. We have explained to our allies what we agreed with Trump in Anchorage. The allies who have been pushing us into negotiations, we probably wouldn't have been so accommodating in engaging with negotiations had our allies not wanted it. But we have already explained to our allies what we agreed with the Americans in Anchorage. The allies told us that they supported that. China, India, Brazil, South Africa, all of them. Now, if it's the Americans who are retreating from Anchorage, if the Americans are taking us back to the position that existed before, well, we can tell our allies, look, it's not up to us. You wanted us to show flexibility. We showed flexibility. You wanted us to meet the Americans halfway. We met the Americans halfway. The Americans agreed with us. Now they are going back on the agreement if negotiations have failed, It's obviously not our doing. We reached an agreement with the Americans in Anchorage, and it was the Americans who didn't honour it. When Putin went out of his way over the course of the Security Council meeting in Moscow 3 days ago to remind the members of the Security Council, the hardliners there, that he had negotiated with Trump, because that was what the allies, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, all of them wanted. He wasn't just reminding the members of the Security Council of that fact. He was also indirectly reminding the allies themselves, China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and all of the others, that an agreement was reached. An agreement was reached between Russia and the United States. A provisional agreement, but not provisional on the Russian side. It was the Americans who were supposed to come back and seal the agreement. Anyway, an agreement was reached between the Americans and the Russians. In Anchorage, it was based on proposals that the Americans made. So if the negotiations have failed, it is not Russia's fault. So that's where we are. And the war will go on. Now, a Ukrainian spokesman, or former spokesman, Yulia Mandl, who used to be the press spokesman of Volodymyr Zelensky, no less, but who has gone over completely to the side of realism, and I would add realism and humanity and compassion and love for her country and its people, has said all that needs to be said about the shambles. And she said this in a message that she posted on X, and I'm going to read it in full. Every subsequent deal for Ukraine will all only be worse, because we are losing people, territory, and the economy. The EU, which, by the way, has paid Russia more than 311 billion euros for energy and goods since February 2022, has no real strategy, no way to stop fueling Russia's budget or support Ukraine enough to win, no direct dialogue with Moscow, and no meaningful leverage over either the Kremlin or Washington. Arguments that Russia has gained so little land sound almost childish when you consider the human cost. We have lost more people in 3 years than some European countries have as their whole population. My country is bleeding out. Many who reflexively oppose every peace proposal because they are defending Ukraine, with all respect, that is the clearest proof that they have no idea what is actually happening on the front lines and inside the country right now. War is not a Hollywood movie. I will never abandon the values that God and democracy place at the very foundation of human existence. Human life is the highest good, and people, living, breathing people, are the ones who must be saved. Well, that's Yulia Mandl. But explain all of that, or try to explain all of that, to Macron and Merz and Ursula and Kaya Kallas and Starmer and all of their sidekicks and all of the various media commentators and fans, all of those people who insist instead that no plan is acceptable unless it is a plan for Russia's capitulation. Mind you, they have no plan, no idea, as Mandl correctly says, about how Russia's capitulation can be achieved, but they insist that that is the only way, the only acceptable way forward. And they're not the only people who say this. Of course, people around Zelensky, his entourage, say it. So does the political class in Kiev. They say it too. And more importantly, and more worryingly for Trump, so do the neocons in the United States. Lindsey Graham has criticised the original 28-point plan, which was, as I said already, a hodgepodge. My colleague and friend, Alex Christoforou, has said in a private email that the 28-point plan was just 28 points for discussion. It was never really a plan. Anyway, he's right about that, but that's something to discuss more fully another time. Anyway, Lindsey Graham is against all of it. He continues to insist that the only peace is acceptable is an honourable peace. Notice that it is an honourable peace, as he defines the word honourable, and bought over the bones of dead Ukrainians. But anyway, that's Lindsey Graham, and he's not the only one, unfortunately. Most of the members of the Senate, and by the way, I suspect most of the members of the House, of course, agree, as does much of the intelligence community, the generals in the Pentagon, the media community in the United States. A political block of people in Washington that Trump has never shown any willingness to take on head on over this issue, assuming, of course, that he has ever wanted to. So there it is. They have no plan. Their philosophy, their entire approach, for me, is set out vividly in an article that I saw recently written by Daniel Hannan, Lord Hannan, in the Daily Telegraph. He complains bitterly that the entire Atlantic system is collapsing and that it's happening because at the hands of a country with an economy smaller than Italy's, which has lost millions of men in the battle and whose economy anyway is collapsing. And he says that this is happening not at the wish of this bankrupt, broken country with its minuscule economy. And of course he's talking about Russia. It is happening at the hands of the United States, because the United States, under Donald Trump, who he again insinuates, by the way, has some kind of mysterious connection with Russia, that the United States is unwilling to exert its full power to bring the Russians to heel. And I'm going to suggest here that we have a lot of the explanation, not the entire explanation, of the European position, why the British and the Europeans, the European elite and the British elite, are so unwilling to acknowledge the realities of, on the battlefronts, of the war, of the fact that Ukraine is winning the war, or rather that Russia is winning the war. If they acknowledge that Russia is winning the war, if they acknowledge that Russia has a vast army, that it has an enormous and powerful weapons industry, that its civilian economy is stable, that it has been able to take on the entire collective West and win overwhelmingly on the strength of its own resources, and that its army is competently led and effectively generaled, then that is admitting that Russia is a great power. And that is something that no European leader, at least none of the important European leaders, are willing to do, because their entire world view since 1989 has been built on the opposite assumption, that Russia is broken, defeated, in decline, that it's got an economy smaller than Italy or Malta or the Galapagos Islands or whatever, that its army is incompetent, bumbling, broken, inefficient, that the government of Russia is a corrupt kleptocracy, all of these things. They built their entire European project on that assumption, and admitting defeat in Ukraine would be to admit that the entire project has an unstable foundation and will fail. And it would also be an admission of something else, which is that the United States is not as powerful as they believe, that the United States does not have infinite power, that it cannot by itself bring Russia to heel, that it can't pull levers or press buttons that will obliterate the Russian economy, that it cannot supply Ukraine with the weapons Ukraine needs in order to achieve that great longed for victory over the Russians. Again, going all the way back to February 2022, to the Munich Security Conference, which I so well remember, I remember the Europeans in a state of absolute intoxication, because they were convinced that America had the power to do all of these things, to destroy and break Russia, and that the sanctions it was working on with the Europeans would achieve that. They were, I remember, in a state of delirious euphoria at the prospect of this, and accepting, admitting that America does not have that power, that it does not have that ability to achieve that thing, again, destroys their worldview and fundamentally undermines their project for the European Union, for European integration that they have built upon it. So there it is. So instead, we must carry on exactly as we have with the war we are losing. We must deny the realities on the front line. We must endlessly agitate and badger the Americans to take more and more extreme action, do more and more extreme things, even if in the process the European economy goes into further decline, because admitting otherwise would demolish our entire worldview and force us to confront realities which we cannot construct. Anyway, I'm not going to spend more time discussing that. The last 24 hours have provided further news from the battlefronts and have given information about further Russian advances across the battlefronts. So the Russians continue to tighten their grip on Pokrovsk. Now, there has been a cascade of commentaries and claims from the Ukrainian side, not all the Ukrainian channels by any means, but from the ones that are closest to the Ukrainian military and the Zelensky leadership, about how Ukraine has won a famous battles in Pokrovsk, that they recaptured the third of Pokrovsk, or half of Pokrovsk, or two-thirds of Pokrovsk, that they broken the siege, that the Russian Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd are no longer trapped, all of that. There's been absolutely not a scintilla of proof, not a single item of video footage that would confirm any of this. If you think that these Ukrainian claims have reality, and if you also think that these Ukrainian claims are disconnected from what is happening in Geneva, from the fact that the Ukrainians are pushing back on the original Witkoff plan, well, if you think those things, then I have a bridge to sell you. Obviously, this has no connection to reality. If you go to some Ukrainian platforms and to more better informed Ukrainian commentators. You could see that immediately, and as to repeat again, there is no Ukrainian footage of any of this. And of course, the Ukrainians know perfectly well that the reason Witkoff was given the green light almost four weeks ago now to restart dialogue with Dmitriev and to cobble together a plan was because, following the confirmation that the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd and Pokrovsk and in Kupiansk were surrounded, the president and some of his officials suddenly realized that all of the stories they were hearing from the Ukrainians about Ukraine successfully holding the line were untrue. So the Ukrainians are trying to restore that narrative, to reinforce that narrative again. And that's, of course, why they're now claiming, and nobody believes these claims, nobody who is really following the situation on the front lines closely believes these claims. Anyway, that's why they're now claiming that they've achieved a successful pushback in Pokrovsk. In fact, what we are actually seeing is that the Russians are continuing to mop up Pokrovsk. The Russian Defense Ministry says that the Russians are still making progress, clearing various positions held by the Ukrainians in Pokrovsk. Footage has appeared on the main supply road to Mirnograd, which the Ukrainians were using until fairly recently, video footage. It shows massive pile-up of the skeletons of burnt-out Ukrainian vehicles trying to send supplies to the Ukrainian garrison in Mirnograd. It's a haunting video, actually. You see the area is still heavily covered by fog and mist, and you see the mist parting at times, and you see these skeletons of vehicles littering the road. I lost count of how many videos I saw. I saw, by the way, some Ukrainian armoured vehicles, BMP-1s, amongst the destroyed, old Soviet BMP-1s, amongst the smashed up vehicles. It looks as if some Ukrainian counterattacks did indeed reach precisely this area, only to be destroyed there, defeated there. It's an extraordinary, haunting picture. And as I discussed yesterday, the reality appears to be that the Russians are actually now in control of this road territory. Anyway, that the Russians have, in fact, taken control of the road. And the Russians, just again to repeat what the Russian Defense Ministry says, it says that assault groups of the Second Army have completely liberated the Gornyak and Shakhtarsky micro districts and continue to mock up Rivne, and they continue their advance, and they the enemy has lost more than 235 up to 35 enemy troops and one US made M113 armored personnel carrier have been neutralized following 8 attacks by the 82nd and 95th Air Assault Brigades and the 425th Assault Regiment of the Ukrainian Armed Forces from Gryshino, trying to unblock the encircled groups of the Ukrainian army. And by the way, the Russians continue to advance in all sorts of other places. They claim to have captured another village called Zatishne in Zaporozhye region. As I understand it, that means that the small town of Stepnogorsk, located to the south of Zaporozhye city, is now well, the is now mostly under Russian control, and that the Ukrainian troops, who are located in a fortified area in the centre of Stepnogorsk, are now effectively surrounded. It is not actually a cauldron, as I understand it. There are still escape routes that the Ukrainians can use, but there are effectively no supply roads. So again, the Ukrainians have the choice of trying to escape these places, but anyway, we will see. And the Russians have also been closing the ring around Orekhov, also in Zaporozhye region. They captured Malaya Tokmachka. They've advanced apparently south of Orekhov. There was a Russian attack there. The Ukrainians claim to have repelled it. Video footage apparently suggests otherwise. Anyway, the Russians have tightened the ring around Orekhov itself. And there are further reports of the Russians preparing to attack Gulyapolye itself. And there are also reports, there are still reports of the Russians continuing to mop up the Ukrainians in Novopavlivka. The fighting in Novopavlivka, it is mostly Raidovka that has been publishing information about it. So we will have to wait further news for what Raidovka says about this. And perhaps most dramatically, further north, the Russians have captured more positions around Siversk. There's fighting, of course, going on in Siversk itself. We've had few details about this, about the state of this fighting, but as I said, Siversk itself is a relatively small town. The Ukrainian brigade that is defending Siversk is an exceptionally tough and strong brigade, but one wonders how long they can keep fighting. The fighting in Siversk, I have to say, this reminds me a little of the fighting in Ugledar about a year ago. Anyway, it's a little like this. Probably we will learn that the defences around Siversk have collapsed suddenly. It seems to me it could happen any day now. So anyway, the situation continues to deteriorate. Apparently some US officials, are those who retain some grasp of reality, are trying to get people in Europe and in Ukraine to acknowledge the obvious truth that Donbass is going to fall under Russian control at some point over the course of the next 12 months. Well, that is obviously true, but I don't believe it is going to be 12 months. Just saying. Remember that the Russian commander, who is in charge of operations in Konstantinovka, about which, by the way, I have no knowledge, I'm not, from where I am, able to keep as much track of situations on the front lines as I have been. Anyway, the Russian commander in charge of operations in Konstantinovka, he has said that he expects most of Konstantinovka, the greater part of Konstantinovka, to be under Russian control by mid-December. Probably that's also gives us a sense of when the Russians expect the Pokrovsk-Mirnograd situation to have been fully resolved by. My guess is that the Russians do continue to work, not just to a plan. They've regularly now confirmed that they are working to a plan, but also to a timetable. I'm guessing that the Russians expect Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Liman, Siversk, perhaps Gulyapolye as well, all of these places to be under their control by mid-December. The next target will presumably be Izium. My guess is the Russians will have taken Izium before the end of the winter, at which point Slovyansk, Kramatorsk will already be effectively encircled. That is, of course, the last significant Ukrainian position in Donbass. If there's an encirclement there, it cannot be defended for very long. Slovyansk, by the way, my understanding is that it's an almost undefendable position. I remember reading the accounts of the attempts of the Donbass militia to try and defend Slovyansk back in the spring of 2014. And I remember quite a lot about the topography around Slovyansk then and how it is on low ground relative to the various hills that are being that are located there. Obviously the Ukrainian army has more forces and probably better trained and equipped forces even now than the Donbass militia did in the spring of 2014. But my guess is that, especially if the supply lines are cut, Slovyansk will quickly become undefendable and might fall much more quickly than some people assume. And of course, if Slovyansk falls, so will Konstantinovka very soon. So will Kramatorsk very soon after. So 12 months might be optimistic if that's how long some people in Washington believe it will take. To repeat again, I'm not a military expert, but I don't think it will take anything like that long. And then, of course, one wonders what will happen. Probably huge recriminations, enormous panic, massive anger in Europe, anger at the Americans, anger on Trump's part towards the Europeans and the Ukrainians as well, by the way, for allowing this crisis to develop. But all of that, of course, is before us. For the record, I understand that the idea of an attack on Venezuela is back on. Again, the administration seems to be unable to make up its mind fully about this. But this is something I'm going to discuss more fully, I suspect, when I return to London. Anyway, this is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Don't forget also to check out our Substack page. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. My next programme will also be made in Scotland, which will be tomorrow, but thereafter I will be back in London again. Thank you again, and look forward to speaking to you one more time from Scotland, and have a good day.